This week, I heard the story of a woman named Abby Odio. And Abby was sharing about an experience that she had as a camp counselor for a special needs camp. And she specifically at this camp was in charge of helping kids cross a high ropes course. And so you can imagine for any elementary age kid, that's pretty daunting. I remember doing that at a camp when I was a kid, and I was like, no way, thank you. And she, you know, is helping kids with special needs get across that. So there's some complications with that, but it's a huge thing. It's important to teach them independence and help them to grow and that sort of thing. And so Abby had this thing that she would do each and every time one of these kids would come up and get ready to cross the high ropes course. She'd get them hooked in and strapped into the harness and all that stuff. And the final thing she would do is she would take the safety cord, you know, the cord that kind of stops you from falling, and she would hook it into their harness, and she would kind of tug on it, and she would look the kid in the eye, and she'd say, hey, you see this? This means you're attached, okay? You're attached no matter what. You're not going to fall. And she would do that. That kind of became her thing. One of these kids came up and was doing the high ropes course, and she went through her whole normal thing, and she put the cord on, and she attached it, and she said this kid's name was actually Abby, which caused her, I think, to remember it in a new way. And she attached the safety cord to Abby, and she let Abby go. And you could hear Abby under her breath. She'd make these tentative little movements, you know, getting started on the course, and you'd hear under her breath go, I'm attached. I'm attached. I'm attached, you know, and kind of taking a little movement. And eventually, of course, as would happen for a lot of kids, right, you make one maneuver, you lose your grip, whatever, and all of a sudden Abby falls, and she's caught by the cord that's there to save her. And everyone was wondering, what was Abby going to do? And she looks around, and she looks back at the camp counselor people, and she raises her hands like she just scored a touchdown in the Super Bowl, and she goes, I'm attached. This is amazing. And Abby shared this story and shared it as an example of, I think, a lot of times what happens with us and God is we walk around and we have this knowledge that we're attached, but we don't really like to put that knowledge to the test very much. And we don't like to jump out into situations and scenarios where it's like, ooh, I better be attached because if I ain't, it ain't going to turn out too well. And I'm not really sure about how I'm going to like that. But yeah, that's exactly what the modus operandi for our lives needs to be if we're going to take big steps to follow Jesus. If we're going to be the kind of courageous people that God calls us to be, the kind of people that make big decisions, that do big things, that make an impact in this world, it requires us to be people who understand, I am attached. I am linked to the God of the universe, that I am actually able to do more than I would ever dream on my own because I'm attached. I got this. I can do this. I'm attached. You see, the big question we're wrestling with today is, what do I believe about God? What do you believe about God? And a lot of times when I ask people this question, they kind of take it in a very theological kind of way. I believe God is three in one. And I go through like all the theological beliefs about God. And that's great. That's important. That's wonderful. I have a paper I paid $80,000 that tells me that's important for. It's sitting somewhere in my guest closet, okay? So that's great. But what I mean about that question today is, like, what do you believe? Like, what's in your heart? What's in your soul? Like, we all have kind of the mental theology about God, but what's actually more important, I've discovered, is my emotional theology about God. Like, what do I really believe in the core of who I am about God and about his work in the world, and specifically about his work with and in me? And if we're going to take big steps to honor God, if we're going to do the courageous thing like this girl we've been looking at, Queen Esther, did, it requires us to really wrestle down, what do we believe about God? Matthew was one of Jesus' first century followers. He was like right there next to Jesus as he was doing all this stuff. And Matthew wrote down a biography of Jesus' life. And in the final words of Matthew's biography of Jesus, he records this promise that Jesus makes. It feels pretty significant. Jesus says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. All of it. Like, I got it all right here, guys. Surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. So right there, Jesus says, I'm the most powerful being in the universe, and I'm always with you. Jesus, in no uncertain terms, it tells his followers, you're attached. I'm attached, okay? The question we have to ask ourselves is not, like, did Jesus promise that we're attached to him? Did Jesus promise that we can place our faith in him? Did Jesus promise that we can remain connected to him? Jesus has settled that question. What Jesus, though, is asking us to do is to believe it, to put our faith in it. James was Jesus' brother, and he wrote this first century letter that we have as kind of an open letter to the church. It actually became a part of the New Testament. It was called James. And in the church I grew up in, they were very frequent to point out this thing that James said. Maybe you've heard it before, even if you're not a Christian. You've probably heard this statement before, that faith without works is dead. And the whole point my church I grew up in, they'd always use that as a very cold theological statement. They'd be like, oh, faith without works is dead, so don't you dare be one of those cultural Christians that doesn't go to church and doesn't give money and doesn't serve, but most importantly, doesn't give money, you know, and those kind of things. And maybe that's an important conversation for us to come back to someday. But today, I actually want to focus on what I think is kind of the corollary to that thing that James says. And it's the whole big idea for today. It's more something to feel than to do, perhaps. But my whole big idea for us is that nothing will make your faith come alive like joining God in a courageous work. That's when you find out you're attached. That's when you find out that something amazing is happening. That if faith without works is dead, what that means is faith with courageous works is very much alive. It is vibrant. It is thriving. It is flourishing. It is growing. A lot of times I have a conversation with someone, and of course being a pastor, I talk with a lot of church people, unsurprisingly, right? And I'll have a conversation that goes something like this, where I'll be like, hey, I just feel like something's missing in my faith. Or if you live, you know, south of the Mason-Dixon line, it's, you know, I feel like I'm not being fed. You know, it's kind of the way that Southern people say it, I feel like. And I understand this is kind of self-serving for me to say it this way, but, like, oftentimes they'll kind of turn their attention to, well, you know, I wish the preaching was deeper. You know, it's like, yeah, I wish it was too. I wish we had a women's Bible study, right? Or I wish we had more programs, or I wish the people were nicer. What they find something about the church to complain about. And what I often kind of challenge them with is, you know, hey, sometimes those criticisms are warranted and good, and we have something to learn. But a lot of times in my experience of doing this for 10 years, what I've kind of discovered is actually, something is missing from your faith. And it's not something in your church. It's the fact that God is calling you to courageous work and you aren't doing it, right? God is saying, get off your butt and get into the game, and you're sitting back on your laurels like you should be proud of yourself. You're sitting back like Jesus died and gave his life, like, oh, so you could sit in a church building and, oh, wow, what an amazing life chant. Like, no, come on, that's a load of junk, right? God is asking you to join him in the redemptive work of the world. Jesus did not come from heaven, die on the cross, resurrect from the dead, so you could feel proud of yourself that you, you know, watch whatever TV network you watch and sit in some pew 26 out of 52 Sundays a year, and when I feel guilty on Mother's Day and Mom invites me to her church, so I could feel impressed with myself. That is not courageous work. The faith that comes alive is faith that has the courage to join God in his work in the world. And if you sit in this chair in this church today, I got grace for you. Everyone from all walks of life, right? You're invited here, whatever you're working through, struggling through. I got nothing but love for you. But man, if you want to see your faith come alive, this is how you do it. It doesn't happen in your comfort zone. It happens outside of it. And that is what today is all about. Queen Esther is a figure that we've looked at. She's this woman. She came to become the queen of the worldwide superpower, rather, when she was like 18, 19 years old, the Medes and the Persians. This happened about 2,500 years ago. Esther's Jewish. She's kept her identity a secret. She knows that's going to be problematic for her. She knows that's going to be something that opens her to discrimination and hatred and problems. Esther, though, also discovers a plot led by a guy in the kingdom named Haman, the number two to the king, King Xerxes, where he's basically gotten the king to sign off on this plot to eliminate the Jewish people. And Esther, all of a sudden, we looked at this last week, became convicted about the idea of, and for such a time as this, I have not received this position, been granted this influence and authority, not to at least speak up and try to use it. And so last week we talked about all the kind of things that courage does in the meantime to get ready for the big thing. Today we talk about doing the big thing. And so Esther, we're just going to kind of start our story here. Esther chapter 5, we're told exactly what Esther does. On the third day, so Esther had been fasting, and on the final day of this fast, Esther put on her royal robes, and she stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. So she just waltzes on in. Now, this is a really big deal, because in the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, if you walked in to visit the king without being invited, that was punishable by death. Okay, so Esther, you know, could very easily just be hauled off, executed, never to be heard from again. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. You got to imagine Esther's there. I would be sweating profusely probably at this point. She's been fasting for 3 days, so I'm already kind of angry probably because, you know, I have a real hanger problem a lot of time. I don't know if anyone else has that. And so it continues on. When the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her. This is the first answer to prayer right here. God allowed the king to be pleased with her. So he held out the gold scepter in his hand. Esther came forward, approached, touched the tip of the scepter. And then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Up to half of the kingdom, it will be given to you." So if I'm Esther at this point, I'm thinking, ooh, I got it made in the shade with lemonade. Okay, I'm feeling pretty good. Like this couldn't have went better. I'm not going to die. The king seems very pleased to grant my request. This seems like it's going pretty well, right? And at this point, I would step forward and be like, well, see, there's this issue that has arisen, O king. But Esther's way smarter than I am. Esther has a plan. So here's what Esther does. "If it pleases the king," said Esther, "let the king, together with Haman," this number two guy who's trying to kill Esther and her people, "come today to a banquet that I have prepared for him." Esther's smart, and she knows it's always better to make a hard ask over food, is what you should learn from the Bible right here. Maybe you should learn that. I don't know. But what Esther is also kind of demonstrating to us here is Esther's willing to embrace some discomfort. Esther has a plan, and she's willing to work it. But what Esther also demonstrates to us is Esther is willing to live with the temporary discomfort that comes when you're trying to do something big, okay? Tell me if you've ever had this experience. You have something sensitive, something hard, something you really don't want to do, but you psych yourself up, you work up the courage to do it, right? You're like in your car, you're listening to like whatever your pump it up music is, you know, like I'm listening to Diana Ross at full volume, I don't know, whatever it is, and I'm like, man, I'm ready to tackle the Ike and Tina, I'm ready to go, man, okay? And then you just come out with like all the ferocity you can manage, and you're just ripping the Band-Aid off, right? You just go out. Now, sometimes that's a good thing to do. Sometimes that's the worst thing that you can do. Okay, parents, tell me if you've ever done this. Did you ever bring your kid aside and you tried to have a conversation that should have been a series of conversations and you tried to do the whole conversation in one conversation? Okay, I'm seeing a lot of children nodding their heads right now, which is like, that's good that we've all experienced that probably, okay? I understand it's uncomfortable and I shudder to think about how many times in my life I've done this where it's, hey, Wes, you're doing too much. You got to live with the discomfort. You got to understand that this is going to take time, and you can't hurry it along. You can't rush it along. You can't move it along. Imagine what this meant for Esther, okay? I mean, Esther's here. She's fearing for her life. She's getting ready to make this defining request. The last thing I would want to do if I'm Esther is wait. Like, even if I'm going to get hauled off and executed, at least I don't have to think about it for a couple, you know, like weeks or days or whatever. Like, I could just get over with and know what's going to happen, you know? And Esther's willing to put up with the anxiety, with the difficulty, with the challenge that that's going to bring. And so she asks the king to come to this banquet. In the next verse, we're told, the king is just like every other guy I've ever met. Right? Oh, food? Where? You know? Bring Haman at once, the king said, so we can do what Esther asked. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. And he continues on. As they were drinking wine, so Esther does the second thing that wise people do. She invited alcohol into the situation, which is always great. It's just a joke. Don't do that. the pastor told me to drink. That was great. That was the best sermon ever. So the king again asked Esther, "What is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Up to half of the kingdom, it'll be granted." Again, sounds kind of like an open runway, but Esther's got a plan. She's working her plan. She knows this isn't the time. And so Esther responds, and here's what she says. Esther replied, "My petition and my request is this." And then she continues on. "If the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request," so hey, I'm going to hinge this on something else, "let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet that I will prepare for them. And then I will answer the king's question. So Esther does something really smart here, Bible scholars figure out. Esther says, essentially, hey, I want to have more food, and kind of the precondition for me telling you what I want is sort of you saying yes in advance, which is kind of cunning on her part, and it's also really a big deal in a culture like this culture of the Medes and the Persians, where your word was your bond. Like you were tied to it. Like the king cannot say no at this point, essentially. And that kind of makes me wonder, and maybe it makes you wonder too, why would he agree to such a thing? Like, why would he do this? And the answer is, I think, because the king trusted her. Because the king knew Esther. They'd probably been together about 5 years at this point, we estimate. And the king knew in that time, Esther does not make a big deal about a lot of stuff, right? The king knew when Esther violated court protocol and risked her life to walk in to see him, like, that must mean something's up, right? Something's on your mind, Esther. Like, something's troubling you. There's something big that I need to pay attention to here. And the king was willing to give her a little bit of leeway because he knew the kind of person that she was. He knew that she is a person that can be trusted. And so he's willing to do that. Now, here's where the story gets really interesting. We didn't go over this part of the story. If you've read along in Esther, maybe you've seen this, but Esther was an orphan, and she was raised by a man named Mordecai, who's her biological uncle. Mordecai uncovered, he like has this job where he's always around the palace gate, and he heard kind of some word at the palace gate, we're told earlier in Esther's story, about these two guys that were conspiring to kill the king. And so Mordecai tells, you know, the appropriate authorities, hey, just want to let you know these two guys are plotting to kill the king. They investigate it. They find out the king's life is saved. And so the king, this night, between these two banquets, he's trying to go to sleep, and he's just stricken with insomnia. He just can't go to sleep. And so the king does something I'm sure we all do when we have trouble sleeping, which is he decides to remind himself about how awesome he is. And so in the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, they would keep this kind of running history of the king's reign. So anytime the king would do something, they would record it in this book that would be preserved basically, you know, for years in the future. They'd be like, oh, what happened during the reign of King Xerxes? Oh, well, we have this book that we wrote during his reign, recording all the stuff that happened. So the king is unable to fall asleep, and he asks one of his servants to come in and read to him from this book. And they get to the point in the book where Mordecai uncovers this plot against the king's life. And the king all of a sudden realizes, oh my goodness, we never did anything to thank Mordecai for saving my life. So the next day, the king wakes up, he's in the palace, he's doing whatever it is he does. And Haman, the king's number two, walks in, and the king looks at Haman and he says, Haman, what should I do for a person that I desire to honor? And Haman thinks to himself, well, who would the king want to honor other than amazing old me? So he says, I know what you should do. You should give this guy your royal robes and clothe him in your royal clothing. You should give him your horse and let him ride around town on your horse. And then get like one of the nobles just to walk around in front of the horse with like a, you know, like a megaphone, right? Like, oh, here's the guy the king wants to honor, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Thinking, of course, it's going to be him. And so the king says, hey, that sounds great, Haman. Why don't you do it for this Jewish guy, Mordecai? You know, which is like kind of a really big little, you know, stick in Haman's pride right there, seeing as Mordecai is the very guy he's trying to get rid of and trying to, you know, rid the world of. So Haman does this. It's surely a very humbling experience for him. Haman gets home. Everyone kind of knows Haman's plot here in his home. His wife and his friends are over, and they say, Haman, this ain't looking good, man. You know, like, I know you're trying to do this whole get rid of Mordecai and his people thing. I mean, maybe it's just me, but this whole, you know, you marching around announcing to the world that the king delights to honor Mordecai doesn't seem like it's working out too well. You might want to rethink this whole let's get rid of the Jews thing. But before Haman can do anything, the limousine gets there to whisk him off to, you know, dinner with the king and Queen Esther. So now Haman, Esther, the king are having dinner. So king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. And as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king again asked, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. And so now Esther sees her opportunity, and she's going to lean in. Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. Spare my people. This is my request." Esther, for the first time, reveals right here, "I'm a Jewish person, and I'm asking you to save me and save my people." Now, Esther has a really hard job right here, because she has to find a way to basically say to the king, "Hey, man, you signed this edict to kill me and my people, which was really stupid and really horrible and really awful." But she needs to find a way to say this to the king without saying, "You're a freaking idiot." You know, like she needs to find a way to do this without hurting the king's feelings, without making him feel bad and casting all the blame onto Haman, okay? So she's got kind of a difficult degree of difficulty coming up here. I don't think this is the first time Esther has rehearsed these words, do you? Okay, she's sitting in the mirror and thinking, "Okay, do it this way. I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. Now, king, if we'd merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet because no such distress would justify disturbing the king." Esther knows the guy she's working with, right? She's kind of buttering him up, dealing with his ego, but she's trying to thread the needle. She's trying to get all this worked out. And so the king replies, and he says, "King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, 'Who is he? Where is he? This man who dared to do such a thing.'" And Esther, I imagine, like this great movie moment, she kind of points her finger and says, "An adversary and enemy, this vile Haman." Then Haman wetteth himself. It's not really what the Bible says. It should. I wish it said that. What actually happened is this. Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. I imagine his face turned white as a sheet because he knows what's going to happen. So then the king got up in a rage and left his wine. This is a big deal. He left his alcohol behind. Now you know he's peeved, okay? He went out into the palace garden. Haman, realizing the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind. He's got one last chance. So he's going to stay behind to beg Queen Esther to spare his life. Then, just as the king returned from the palace guard to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. And this didn't go over so well with the king because he said, "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" Now, what kind of happened here is we think the king walked in and basically purposefully saw what he wanted to see, because here was, like, even God is even at work in the way that Haman begs for his life. Because what's kind of funny is the king was not going to have an easy time getting rid of Haman for enforcing a law that the king signed. Like, how dare you enforce the law? You know, like, well, you're the one that allowed me to, right? You're the one that signed it. But on the matter of, hey, the king walked in and he saw someone trying to sexually assault the queen, that's going to be a pretty open and shut case, I think, pretty much. Like, I think there's going to be, you know, not a whole lot of grace in that situation. So the king walks in, he kind of sees this, he sees his opportunity, he accuses Haman. And then this is my favorite part, like the whole book of Esther is what's coming up. As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face, right? The axe man walks in, kind of covers his face. This is my favorite part. Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, one of the servants. So Haman had built this pole outside of his house that he was going to impale Mordecai on, like in his zeal to, like, you know, take care of the Jews. I love, this shows you how much everyone hated Haman, okay? Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, "Hey, just like you should know, king, a pole reaching to a height of about 75 feet stands outside of Haman's house. Think we should do something with it? You know, you think we should use it for something? I don't know." You know, he had set up, but just so you know, he had set up for Mordecai, you know, that guy that helped you that one time. "What do you think we should do?" "I don't really know." You know? The king said, "Oh, well, let's impale him on it." So, this gets a little violent here, so they impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided, okay? Ladies, if you ever try to talk your husband or your boyfriend and being like, "Man, he just never wants to read the Bible. Just have him read this part of the Bible," okay? It's like, you know, 300 or something right here, okay? So, kind of poetic justice right here, right? Haman ends up, you know, impaled, I guess, by his own plan here, yeah? Now, the queen, Esther, has just done a pretty significant thing. In the span of about 48 hours, she's taken her life in her own hands, and she's been blessed with the pure grace of God that she leaves this situation with her life still intact. Now, I wish I could look at you today and be like, hey, whatever that bold, courageous thing is that you've been putting off, that you've been wondering about, I wish I could tell you, hey, don't worry, it's going to work out great. Don't worry, everything's going to go awesome. Don't worry. Like, what are you waiting for? You know, it's going to be perfect. You don't need to be afraid or concerned at all. But I can't, because life doesn't work that way. And as we've talked about, right, Esther is all about God's work behind the scenes. It's all about God's work that happens when he isn't noticed. And I can't guarantee you that whatever it is that you feel the calling to take action on is going to work out the way you expect or wish or hope. In fact, it may very well be something that you lean into, that God actually works behind the scenes to deliver the end result that he desires. But what I can tell you is this, it's where we started, is that nothing's going to make your faith come alive like joining God in a courageous work. And so my encouragement to you is I want you to join him in his courageous work. And I think each part of that phrase is important. It starts with joining God. This is not a, as we are sometimes prone to do, this is not a, hey, God, let me come up with an agenda, and then I'll just tack you on at the end of it, okay? That's not how this works. This is partnering with God. This is joining God in his work. But what I am here to tell you is if you want to experience connection to Jesus, if you want to experience, I'm attached, it happens when you get out of your comfort zone to join God in the work that he is seeking and desiring to do. I wish I could make taking the big step easier. I can't. But what I can tell you is four different things I think we see Esther and her living faith, her courageous faith, put into practice for us. The first thing that she does is living faith takes initiative. We spoke about this last week, but courageous people understand things don't just get better on their own. They don't magically change. It's not like all of a sudden, just overnight, that issue goes away. In a broken world with broken people, what we naturally default to is more brokenness. And so if you take nothing else away, take this away, that courageous faith, living faith, it at least notices and does something about it. Not deciding anything is a decision to do nothing. Living faith takes initiative to do something, to join God in what it is that he is desiring and designing to do. A second thing that living faith does, living faith makes a plan. Esther did not walk into this situation and just off the hip come up with this idea, let's have a banquet. That sounds good, you know? Maybe I'll go later, you know, and do that kind of thing. Esther had a very clearly thought out intention plan. She took into and assessed who she was dealing with, the kind of culture she lived in, the people involved, what she was trying to achieve, okay? Esther made a very wise plan. I feel like sometimes we do this thing in our world where we look at people who make plans and we kind of shame them a little bit because we're like, well, that's not very authentic. That feels kind of manipulative. And I think, no, that actually is called wise. If you're going to do something hard, you should have the courage to put the forethought in to do it well. because I don't know how many plans have worked out when I just kind of authentically went in and did what felt right, but I know the success rate is a lot higher when you think in advance before doing something, and we should heed that wisdom in the way that we take next steps to try and honor and follow Jesus. A third thing living faith does, living faith embraces temporary discomfort. Esther was willing to live with 48 hours, in fact, 72 hours, if you count her like fasting beforehand and all this stuff, of wondering, gosh, I wonder if I'm going to die or not. That isn't something I really like to think about, you know? Like, that's not something that I can imagine myself being like, yeah, it feels really relaxing, you know, to wonder that. But living faith understands if I want to do something courageous, it's probably going to require a season of temporary discomfort in my life. And that's true whether you're just trying to do something on your own. It's especially true if you're trying to lead someone else to join you in doing something. If you have a relationship that's off the rails, if your marriage is messed up, you're going to have to embrace some temporary discomfort in making it right. You're going to have to embrace the temporary discomfort of talking to your spouse or talking to your friend or talking to your significant other and saying, hey, this is messed up. This is wrong. And you're probably going to have to own the temporary discomfort of saying, I'm wrong, and I messed up, and I did this wrong. If you've made a habit of cutting corners at work and doing the wrong thing at work, if you've made a habit of, hey, I was called to lead this people and this group to do something, and I've just been taking the easy way out, I've been lazy, I've kind of left this stuff unaddressed, you're going to have to embrace the temporary discomfort of saying, hey, up until now, I've not done a really good job, and we need a hard reset on this. If you've lived your whole life with this bad habit, this behavior, this thing, right? You're going to have to embrace the temporary comfort that comes when we utter aloud the most dreaded words for any American male, which is, I need help, okay? Things aren't going to change without some temporary discomfort. And usually the temporary discomfort is going to be longer than 5 minutes. And living faith understands that, and it risks that. Jesus lived for 33 years with temporary discomfort. He knew how it was going to end. Jesus lived for 3 years with temporary discomfort when he recruited his 12 disciples, and he made sure one of them was going to be a traitor to him. Jesus lived with temporary discomfort to the point that we're told when he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane before he was going to be arrested, he sweat drops of blood. Now, I'm no doctor. I don't think that's usually, hey, your diet and your stress level is nice and low. You know, good job out of you, right? You know, sweat and blood, you know, like you sign of perfect health, you know? No, that's a sign of extreme stress. Courage embraces temporary discomfort. And here's the final thing courage does. This might be the hardest thing. Living faith, the courage that practices living faith, it earns trust with people. This is the thing that probably requires the most patience, actually. Because trust, you can't microwave it. You can't make it instantaneous. Trust is something that you earn over time. Esther earned trust with King Xerxes, which gave her the leeway to be able to lead and leverage King Xerxes to do something great. If you want to lead people to do something great, it probably won't happen if they don't trust you. John Maxwell is a leadership coach, and he has a statement that he says where people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's really wise advice for us. Some of you know this about me. I work during the week, you know, at different places around town. So there's a coffee shop near our house, and there's the McDonald's just up the street from here at South Monroe. And I'll work from the lobby of those two areas. And the whole reason I do that is because I know in my proximity, you know, I work for a very large organization that has one employee, and the employee is me. And so I know I need to be around people. And I know, hey, I'm not going to do a very good job at helping disconnected people connect to God if I'm never around disconnected people, right? And so I have these kind of two places where I decided I want to be a regular. And at different points in those places, I've discovered, you know, I've thought to myself, I've complained aloud, like, oh, man, they probably think I'm such an idiot here. You know, one of the places I go is Lucky Goat. So it's like all hipster 20-year-olds are like, oh, I have my Bavarian latte, you know, or whatever. And this coffee has notes of tobacco. I'm like, oh, this coffee has notes of beans that have been boiled in water. Oh, wow, you know, that kind of thing, right? I go to McDonald's, and this will probably shock you. There's not a lot of guys that are whipping open their MacBook Pro in the, you know, lobby of the McDonald's and, you know, bringing their Bible commentaries to, you know, sit and read there or anything like that. At different points, I thought, man, people probably think I'm such an idiot. You know, like, they probably think I'm so stupid looking right here. And what's been kind of crazy to me is over time of doing that, I came this week around about a year of doing that. And what was kind of funny to me is I discovered that over time in these places where at different points I thought, man, I'm doing nothing to earn trust with people. I've had like people at both of those settings say, you know, like do things that demonstrate like there's a relationship there. There's a friendship there. There has been trust that is earned there. Which is really exciting because what that means is I have a little leverage in those places to lead. You have some leverage to lead, but it starts with the people who trust you. Like I said, I do not know how everything in your story is going to work out. I wish I did. What I do know is your faith is going to grow. Because when you take the big step, what you discover is, I'm attached. I'm attached. I'm connected. And the God who is connected to you wants to connect others to him, and we get the opportunity to join him in doing that great work. Let me pray for us to do that. Father God, thank you for the wisdom that we learn from Esther's story. God, thank you for the wisdom that we see and understand from her. I pray for each and every person in this room, the courageous work that you've called them to do. God, Christian or not, I know you want to use each and every one of us in this room to make a difference in this world. And so, Father, I pray you would use us to do just that. Help us get out of our comfort zone. Give us the wisdom to know what you're leading us to do. Give us the courage to step out of our comfort zone and to do it. And God, I pray the whole way as we do so, we discover that we are attached. And I pray this, Jesus, in your powerful and perfect name. Amen.